Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Please note that this episode of Waypoint Radio contains a content warning for discussion of abuse. Captain Spirit doesn't open with an abusive father screaming and hitting his son. Instead, the game depicts Chris's father as someone who cares deeply about his kid, taking a genuine interest in his thoughts, observations, and superhero antics. But soon, he pours a beer for breakfast. Then, he asks if anyone noticed the marks on his arm. He eventually passes out. Video games have always depicted all manner of violence, but is traditionally grotesque and over-the-top, issuing nuance in favor of fetishized aesthetic hyperbole. Though the Life is Strange series is known for melodrama, it started by telling stories about teenagers dealing with unexpected sci-fi powers, after all, it worked because it felt grounded in the kinds of problems anyone could relate to. Life, death, friends, family, everyone's been there. Captain Spirit is no different.
That, of course, is the voice of Patrick Klepek from his piece, Captain Spirit Tells a Fictional Story of Abuse. These people lived one. I'm Danielle Riendo, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 177. Joining me, in addition to Patrick today, are Rob Zachney.
Hello, hello.
And Natalie Watson.
Hi, hi.
And we're digging into some pretty heavy stuff today, so hence, obviously, that sort of content warning up top. But this seemed like a really, really good place to talk about abuse in games and the ways in which abuse has been handled in games, specifically in terms of characters and whether they have redeeming arcs and so on and so forth. Captain Spirit is a pretty natural place to start with that, obviously, since it's a pretty recent game and it has something of a nuanced take on what child abuse can look like, especially, I think, Patrick, when you're writing about how sort of it is absolutely a game about abuse, but it's also a game about sort of contending with very, very deep personal fears. Fears that you even have said that you've had. Like, what would happen to me if, you know, something like this happened to me? So I think that's probably a pretty good place to start. Have either Rob and Natalie, have either of you looked at Captain Spirit at all by any chance?
I have not. I've only sort of read what we've reported on it so far.
Sure.
And I was actually just watching another E3 sort of explainer, and Captain Spirit came up again like 10 minutes ago. So yeah, that's the extent of my familiarity with the game.
Sure. Very much the gist of the game is that there's a little boy named Chris, obviously, and he very much escapes his abuse. He escapes kind of the parental abuse that he suffers from by sort of pretending he's a superhero, and he feels powerful in his life. And the tasks that you do in the game, it's a pretty short game. The tasks that you do involve him sort of becoming more powerful and, you know, overcoming his fears. Things like, oh, going into this creepy basement and sort of fixing things, or to, you know, get the laundry away. Doing all of these little things that I think it was said in the piece that real, you know, survivors of abuse remember doing as children, to kind of get out of the way of an abusive parent or to sort of help out around the house and not want to be blamed for things like messes. So, Patrick, sorry, I'm going on and on setting this up here, but do you want to talk a little bit about the piece and sort of where you were coming from in writing it?
Yeah, I mean, I hopefully made the distinction that I didn't foresee an alternate universe where if my wife was to suddenly pass away, that I would turn into a child abuser.
Of course.
It's more that I
just
think
a fuck
the,
up.
Just a fuck. Well, that's I mean, right. I mean, yes, right. Like, so that's I think the illustrative and empathetic portrayal that comes through in the story is where, like, I think a lot of people would rightfully draw the line and go, like, you know, okay, yeah, I could see myself having some moral failings and things like that, like probably, hopefully not becoming a child abuser as a result. But like, there is a really interesting portrayal of a father, or, you know, you can swap, you could gender swap that, you know, you could shift these roles around in a lot of different ways. But essentially, like, the failing, the natural failings of a person when put in a situation that is impossible to imagine how any of us would respond. And it's easy to understand how any of us might respond by not being our best self. And I have, that is, as I illustrated in a piece I wrote reviewing Captain Spirit, was like something I think about all the time that I never really thought about until I had a kid, just because the stakes weren't nearly as high, right? It's yeah. Like, you know, I mean, I don't want to lose my partner, but that's like a whole lot different than where I'm at now, where it's like owning a house and you having a kid. It's just like, what you have to lose, like the responsibilities on your plate are just so much different than, you know, just choosing to enter a relationship with someone and sort of the emotional stuff that goes along with that. I think Captain Spirit does like a really good job of making you feel shitty for feeling empathy, which is like a very difficult thing to pull off, in that, you know, like when I would think about it, and it was such a delicate thing to write, because as I'd be writing, I'd go, right, but like, he might have, like, hit his kid. So, like, why am I showing any empathy for this person? It's like, oh, well, because all the other stuff in the game builds, like, how this person fell into this hole. And you start to put together, well, how did this person get into that hole? Like, well, it probably started with the drinking. And then it probably led to this. And it probably led to that. And so you may not forgive the person for their acts because of their unforgivable transgressions. Yet, like, being able to chart a course for the character gives you a certain amount of empathy, even if you don't forgive them for the actions they take as a result of that like terrible journey. And that's just a really difficult sort of like high wire act for a game to pull off, for a narrative to pull off. Like, you know, I think games do a very good job, or are uniquely situated to provide that sort of context, because games as a medium have avenues for like lore dumping that just don't really work as well in especially in movies, right? In television, I think like exposition is really difficult to pull off in those sorts of mediums, but games have all ample opportunity to do exposition and world building in a way that allows you to sort of like bridge those gaps. So that was kind of my takeaway from Captain Spirit, was like on a larger like 20,000 foot scale, was like the successful ability to build empathy for a character that you ultimately really shouldn't feel bad for and don't feel bad for, and yet still you find yourself kind of scratching every once in a while and going, which is pretty rare.
Yeah, something I am a little, not wary of is the wrong word, but I actually don't take much of an issue with stories that humanize or allow us to sympathize with people who are toxic, people who are abusive, like, for lack of a better word, like, you're humanizing them. And that, I think there's a line between sort of painting a, like, fully three-dimensional portrait of somebody versus rightfully condemning them as, you know, condemning them for their behavior, but also, and then in the process, reducing them to like cartoonish monsters. And this is
right.
Like, this is hard to parse, but the way I would put this is like, there are people who absolutely are like almost gothic villains, who are just like so shitty, so cruel, you know, so manipulative. And consciously so, and choose to do so, that they do like fit into some of our darkest stereotypes of what abuse looks like. In a lot of cases, that isn't what it looks like. And those are the harder cases to recognize. And I think that is maybe the experience, that the more common experience, abuse that sometimes is even difficult to recognize as abuse. And I think there's value in telling those stories as well, and sort of presenting characters who we can recognize their humanity. We can sympathize with the hand they've been dealt and the struggles they're going through. At the same time, we can also recognize that like they are inflicting like grievous harm through their behavior, and that is also who they are. And I think a tricky thing about narratives and stories is that I think they can sometimes reduce things into these really explanatory, like the way we said a moment ago about like, oh, you can see how this person fell into this hole. I do get skeptical of stories that say like, ah, here's the thing that made a good person go bad. Here's the, sure. You know, here's the thing that like sort of altered their trajectory. Cause I think that is often kind of too, you know, simplifying an explanation, But then also it can lead to stories that, I don't know, promote kind of a toxic view of how people like this are. We're like, oh, if only there were a way to redeem them.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
or
right,
like that there's something right. you can say or like some realization you can lead them to that like, okay, now they'll be good again.
If she came back from the dead through a magic spell, that suddenly he would stop being a shitty father. Like, the key to those narratives, and I'm not sure if Captain Spirit pulls this off as much as you're suggesting it could have, but yeah, it's where like putting in evidence that, well, like this was here before, right? Because like a person doesn't just turn in to an abuser, maybe a process, but there's evidence along the way of like a toxic personality or toxic behavior. I'm not sure I was maybe that is in Captain Spirit and I just didn't come across it or didn't see it, you know, because so many things are optional in that game. Like the view you get of a character is often built around like, you know, what scraps that you found and what you're able to, but you are right. Like most people are not a binary flip. Like it is a case where there was probably something wrong in that relationship before. And it's just that these events amplify the toxicity to a point that, you know, there's a point of no return. And yeah, good narratives find a way to like at least let you know like, okay, like there was a slippery slope here, but like let's not pretend everything was great before.
Right. I think or an inability. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Natalie. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to – I think that's definitely true. The thing that I – that like kind of – I don't know – that I get stuck on is the sort of reliance or not the grounding or like the catalyst being like addiction or like alcoholism in this case, because I do, you know, as someone who has a lot of experience with loved ones having problems with addiction or being alcoholics and going through recovery, like there is something about those things that are very mind altering and personality altering and behavior altering. And although they may bring out things that, you know, typically we suppress as like functioning members of society and, you know, people that want to be personable and things like that, the things we feel sometimes or the things that we want to do, we suppress because we know they're not right, that, you know, drugs and alcohol may lower those inhibitors. And so for me, having this sort of basis in alcoholism and addiction makes me a little bit more, I don't know if it's sympathetic, but maybe more like I hope for more of a redemption arc I think there's more of a possibility for a redemption arc in this case because there is something else, you know, at work here that is outside of this person that is engaging with the demons inside that is like amplifying them to a further extent. So that is where like these things get tricky for me in these sort of narratives that have this layer to them.
Yeah. And adding to that, I think another character that we're going to talk about today a little bit, and I apologize to everyone who is sick of hearing about the Bloody Baron, because that's all that game journalists talk about from Witcher 3. But I promise we have other stuff from Witcher 3, too. So don't worry. But the Bloody Baron quest in The Witcher 3 is also very much a story about, in many ways, alcohol abuse as well as spousal abuse. And I actually went and watched the entire thing last night, like the 3-hour little movie of this quest that somebody had put together, because it has been, you know, 3 years since I played it. But it is very, very, very much it's something that struck me as being, and sorry to get a little real here, but I have seen this on 911 calls. I have seen this kind of scene sort of in real life in real domestic abuse cases. And the quest goes as such, in case if you're not familiar with it, Geralt in the game has to find Ciri, whatever, he comes across this Bloody Baron, this sort of local ruler, local tough guy who has, he needs help finding his wife and daughter. And it turns out he was abusive to his wife, extremely, extremely abusive to his wife, physically abusive. He would get drunk and he would beat her. And there's sort of an exchange kind of early on in this quest. I'll just sort of read from it. The Baron says, "She always knew how to spark my ire." And Geralt says, "Your wife, how'd she make you angry?" And he kind of makes a sarcastic comment. "Too much salt in the soup. Socks never..." Something about the socks. I didn't quite get that. And the Baron says, "20 years..." It's something about the... Not your dog sock. I don't know. He made some weird joke about socks. It's fine, yeah. And the Baron says, 20 years we've known each other. She's seen me drunk and sober. She was there to greet me when I returned the victor. She was there to patch me up in defeat. Like no other, she knew where to press, where to pinch so it would hurt. And Geralt said, "You beat her for that, for criticizing you." And then sort of later on in the quest, there's layers of complication added where it kind of comes out that the Baron was this great soldier who went off to war all the time. He came back and he found that his wife had been cheating on him. In a murderous rage, he killed the guy, and the wife tried to stab him. And so he hits her, and that's the first time he hits her. And then they kind of have this horrible, terrifying pattern of abuse. He causes her to miscarry a child. It's a dark, dark, dark storyline. But what struck me last night watching it again was how much Geralt's sort of initial walking around the house, his initial sort of, figuring out something is not quite right here, really, really, really hit home to some sort of like domestic abuse cases I've been on as an EMT, where I'm there to sort of treat the patient and this is what's going on. And people are there to investigate what's going on and looking at the house and looking at injuries and looking at all this stuff. And it really struck me as something that was both incredibly difficult to watch and incredibly difficult to play at the time. And also now with that sort of further context in my own life, and I'll just be honest about this, I am also an abuse survivor. So it's not as if I see something realistic only from sort of other people's lives. It is something I've experienced in some degree in my own life. But it struck me as being, wow, this is really realistic, obviously, in terms of The Witcher, where it's a world where there are monsters and ghosts and other things. But in terms of being realistic, emotionally speaking, it really struck me how much that felt like, oh, this feels like it was written from either a place of experience or someone really kind of did their homework here. And Rob, I know you probably have some thoughts on this quest. It's also something we've talked about in terms of Witcher 3. But I'm curious to hear everybody's thoughts on this, if you have any experience with it, as well as that sort of context, Natalie, that you have towards substance abuse as a catalyst for some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Rob, did you want to go first?
No, I'm happy to let someone else go first, like, because I know Patrick also wrote a piece on it. So like, literally everybody has shit to say about this. I'm happy.
Everybody's excited about this one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, excited is a word.
Sure is a word.
Let's dig into this banquet.
I can't remember exactly. I do know that I wrote a feature for Kotaku interviewing the quest designers behind the Bloody Baron quest. And I remember them. There was a point at some point in the feature where they did say that, like, they had some, one of the quest designers, I don't believe they had firsthand experience being an abuse survivor, but had been part of growing up. They had been witness to various forms of abuse that informed how they tried to lend a measure of authenticity to the quest, which I think, like, speaks a lot to, you know, when we talk about, like, you know, like, bringing in people from diverse backgrounds and bringing in people that can, you know, draw on real life experiences. Like, there's the authenticity of the Bloody Baron quest is, like, a huge part of why it has emotional resonance, like, regardless of your own personal experience. Like, I am not an abuse survivor, but like, the fact that it both speaks to people who, like Danielle, like yourself, like, who have had that, and that for me, you know, it works on multiple levels from multiple angles, from multiple experiences. And I think it, like, really speaks to, like, what is useful about having people who have lived that part of that life in order to bring a certain, you know, degree of authenticity to that experience. And yeah, I remember, like, what's interesting is about is that you have, relative to Captain Spirit, you don't have a lot of agency over the outcome of the story. Like, the story is the story, and what you're really doing in Captain Spirit is just kind of walking around and completing some side quests, and then a thing happens at the end that maybe gives you some hope about the future, but it doesn't really do anything definitive. There is no real conclusion. It, like, ends on a cliffhanger, sort of like a satisfying cliffhanger narratively, but it's not full resolution for these characters. You know, like, you know, the kid is still in that abusive home at the end of that of Captain Spirit. And what's different about The Witcher is, like, The Witcher is a story, is a game built explicitly on, like, making big choices, like, forking in the road in terms of, like, you know, what happens next. And in this quest specifically, I remember it giving you all sorts of dialogue options that allowed you, that didn't necessarily have a, I mean, it did have big impacts on how the quest finished, but more specifically what I was impressed by was your ability to, like, make emotional condemnations or judgments of the Bloody Baron as a character, in which, you know, you could say, like, you know, tell him, you know, actually you are a, like, you're a fuck up, like, you're a bad person. Like, you could say the thing that, like, you're shouting at the screen, but the character never says. And, like, a lot of the dialogue in Bloody Baron is really effective because it feels as though it's actually giving the player options that they would have a natural response to. And sure, it still fits in Geralt's character, but more importantly, it fits with, like, how a player would naturally feel about, like, wanting to yell and wring the neck of this person. And, like, you actually get to say those. So you get to say, you get to say the thing, but then, like, badass Geralt is, like, the one actually saying it, like, makes me feel even better about the outcome. But that's a really, it's part of why that quest line is so impressive, because of both, like, the different directions it can go, like, the way it can finish out is radically different. But then just sort of, like, the emotional responses the player is given agency over, I thought was really impressive.
I think I totally understand the criticism and sympathize with the criticism of the Bloody Baron quest. Like, the guy does unforgivably bad things. Like, literally, he commits a murder, like, through violent abuse, like, induces a miscarriage. Like, this guy is doubly damned and triply damned. And I totally understand the argument that the guys didn't deserve the possibility of, like, the mild redemption that quest can give him in its resolution. And it doesn't, and a character like that shouldn't be the one who gets to tell the story, who gets to frame everything that you hear about the story is through his eyes. You do talk to the daughter, and, like, a lot of, like, you know, a lot of it does end up tracking. Fundamentally, like, we're not given much reason to suspect the Bloody Baron is a particularly unreliable narrator, but nevertheless, like, it's all his view of things, and he's the one, it's his story, it's not his daughter's, it sure as shit isn't his wife. I understand that criticism. I'm also sympathetic to the idea that, to a degree, it is dangerous to put out stories that portray, like, toxic abusers as being particularly redeemable, because I think a lot of people, because what that says is, like, that is putting out there this idea that if you just wait around long enough, if you just sit there and you take it long enough, maybe eventually behavior will change and the person will come. Like, and that's an incredibly dangerous and destructive thing to put out there.
Yeah, definitely.
But isn't it the player choice in Bloody Baron? Like, if you are, if the conclude the story isn't the quest writer saying he is redeemed? It is you, as the character you are playing, making an active choice to say, "I see redemption in this character." But I think it's, like, a very different result. Like, there you are again. I haven't watched the whole thing again, but I remember distinctly it being, if there is redemption, it is because you have chosen to bestow it on the character,
but
not
why?
Because the quest designer said, "Oh, this is the way the story ends." Like, you as the player are choosing, I am granting redemption to this person.
But why even offer redemption?
Because players, like, are shitty, and they should reflect on the fact that if they chose that option, they are shitty people.
But is there anything in the game then that reflects that that was a shitty decision to make? Because I don't know.
Make it.
I don't see the value of that if that's the statement you're trying to make. If you're trying to say, like, oh, if you do choose to redeem this abusive person, then, you know, the game will kind of be chastise you for that, or reflect in some way that that was a bad thing to do. Or will the game just proceed? Like, the game is always going to proceed because that's how games work. Games are always going to just continue and keep going. And that's just, I don't see the value in even giving that offering unless you're...
Well, Sox is not fucking
having
it.
Just
fuck that bullshit.
I'm with Sox.
Sox is very upset about it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Are you fine?
So, the thing I'll say to that, though, is... Like, again, I sympathize with that argument and understand it, and to a degree might even agree with it, but here's the other thing. Is that to an extent, people do change, And it's not through process. It's not this magic like Hallmark redemption thing. It's sometimes people do horrible, abusive shit, and then for a variety of reasons, usually not through any sort of like any catalyzing event that you can point to in a narrative sense. Like, here's the moment everything changed and they became good again. Sometimes people just change and they do reconcile with their families. Like, what resonates with me in a quest like that is, you know, cards on the table here. Like, for years, like, you know, my father was an alcoholic, and I think could be described as abusive for good portions of that. And I didn't get it. Like, I didn't deal with it nearly as badly as like my sister did, who was older, and had to deal with him being an alcoholic longer. But the point is, when I look back at that, there was a lot of stuff that transpired that was going to be hard for the family to move past. But at the same time, like, we did, you know what I mean? Like, the story that maybe like my mom or my sister needed to hear, you know, back then was somebody being like, you shouldn't have to like deal with a person like this, like, get this person out of your fucking life. Like, that shit, right. Like, maybe that's the story that is more useful and responsible to tell. But at the same time, it's not actually the story that, like, happened, right? Like, right. Like, here's the other, the one thing I'll say is, if you wanted to have a version of that story where the switch gets flipped and, like, something makes the character wake up, you could argue that there were light bulb moments that happened for my dad. You could argue that, like, there were certain confrontations between, like, him and my mom, and certainly between him and me, that, like, started to change things around. Thing is, though, the light bulb moment happened, like, a dozen times. It didn't change shit. Like, not at first. You know what I mean? Like, there's no one moment you'd point to and say, like, ah, the person became good. It just, through a slow process, my father, like, changed and moved past that. And the family recovered from that and healed. And I would say largely we've been pretty happy now. Like, you know, within reason for families. Yeah. But so when I look at a story like this and everyone's like, well, that guy, you know, that guy deserves to go to hell. And they aren't remotely comparable experiences. But at the same time, when I see like the Bloody Baron, like with his self-pitying rants, you know, weeping, drunk off his ass, trying to like explain why he was shitty, like, that's my life out there. And I'm glad that there was a story that reflected some of that and it wasn't easy and doesn't offer an easy moral. But I don't think stories like this, I don't think dynamics like that within families allow for a lot of easy generalizing or morals.
I wonder if part of the problem with video games is like what happened with you, Rob, sounds like something that, you know, spanned years and years and years, like, you know, for the full course of events. You know, this quest line, even though it's very long, like, it very long means 3 hours, right? So I think part of the difficulty in portraying sort of abuse narratives in video games may just be like length. As long as games are, that still doesn't necessarily give the full breadth of time to give that room to breathe where you could understand, like, when you compress the changing of a person's personality or behavior into, you know, most quests are 15, 20 minutes, right? Like, you know, this is 3 hours. Like, that's like a full, you know, long movie, extended edition movie length to tell a story. Yeah. And even then, if you come across from it going like, oh, well, this feels a little fast. Well, it's like, that's maybe inherent to the medium where it's extremely difficult to convey that passage of time. Even if you were to put it on screen a year later, well, it's, you know, that's not a year later for the person. Like, their life hasn't evolved over a year where they maybe had time to process and learn to forgive or, you know, all the things that go into moments like that. But in a game, like, by the nature of how they're built, like, things just have to flip in a certain way that makes it difficult for you to kind of see how that could change over time.
Totally. And I think the one thing that is, I don't know, a little bit strange about the medium of a game itself to tell these kind of narratives is that the player I am the catalyst in this other person's narrative. And like right. what you were saying, Rob, it is such an internal process. It doesn't matter how many conversations you've had. I mean, I had a partner at a very young age that was a drug addict, and it didn't matter how many conversations I had with him at the time. There was nothing that was going to change his mind until he made that internal realization. And so that's the kind of weird thing about telling this sort of, like, by grounding this sort of narrative abuse in sort of addiction or alcoholism in this case, because it is something that we're saying, or something that we, external to the situation, that is supposed to make a change in these people's lives. And that's just not how it works. It's just, it, which is, it's hard to participate in, and it's hard to, I mean, I haven't played the Bloody Baron quest, but but again, like you were saying, Rob, I am sympathetic to the potential for that rehabilitation. I am, you know, hopeful for that. That's something I've been hopeful for many people in my life and in the past. And so seeing that possibility in these narratives is important to me. But I just don't see how me, Geralt, has a place in right. this, because it's just not how it works, unfortunately. I wish it was, yeah. but...
And this one is difficult, of course, because this is a pretty dark and, again, like, it feels like a pretty resonant quest. It was resonant with a lot of people, but it is absolutely shoehorned into... Not shoehorned into. I don't want to make... have a completely negative connotation here, but it is dropped within a fairly traditional game structure, right? Of an open world, you are a badass, you are the New York Witcher, you know, kind of thing. You are the you know, the plumber of the place, you are an awesome badass, there's monsters and all this other stuff. And mm-hmm. it is contending with that idea of you're the player and you are the most powerful person in this world. I think The Witcher hides
you are
that
God.
So much better. Yeah, basically. The Witcher hides that so much better than most other games of its ilk. And that's something we've talked. We have a whole year of Idle Weekend episodes on how much the world of The Witcher feels much more lived in and much more believable, because you can't make every great decision. You can't be the most powerful that you are in so many other games. I do think it actually has a lot more nuance than most games of its type. But it does still have to contend with this in that way of you being this catalyst for change and you being this really important person who made certain realizations happen in this quest. And that is a structural difficulty. And it's something that is handled in Captain Spirit in a very different way, in that you are essentially completely powerless in this game. And that game is all about creating an illusion of power for yourself as a child. Which I think mm-hmm. is really thematically powerful and cool and done well. But there are different types of games with different types of gameplay verbs that sort of all coalesce around these themes, right? So yeah. I do also want to bring up another thing from The Witcher, which, Rob, I think you'll be able to speak to this a little bit more, because my history with The Witcher is only Witcher 3. But the idea that Triss, who's someone you have a relationship with as Geralt, has been... doing some pretty non-consensual things to Geralt and in terms of their relationship. And that is pretty messed up. Do you want to set that up a little bit, Rob?
Yeah, like, that's the thing. I think there is sort of, there are sort of larger threads running through the Witcher series and that start to really yeah. pay off in The Witcher 3. But one of them is that when The Witcher 1 opens, Geralt has amnesia. He's sort of been recovered by his friends at Witcher HQ at Kaer Morhen. And
Witcher HQ.
he has no memory of what the hell happened to him or why he's ended up here, but everyone remembers him. And there's Triss, who is like, oh, you don't remember anything about like who we are to each other and all of this. And like, you strike up a relationship, and by the start of The Witcher 2, like, you're a couple. No matter what choice you make in Witcher 1, like, Witcher 2 opens, you are a couple and you're like partners, basically, in this world. And then, like, pretty much the end of the first act of Witcher 1, somebody lets something slip. I don't remember exactly how, but somebody lets something slip that, like, oh yeah, you know, Geralt, you had a kid. And you're also like, well, what now? Like, first I've heard of it. And he goes and he sits down with Triss and he's like, look, I need you to tell me what you're not telling me. Like, and however much it's going to hurt me to hear it, how much it's going to hurt you to talk about it, like, I need to know what you've been keeping from me. And what she's been keeping from Geralt, and what all his fucking friends have been keeping from him, is that he was fucking married to Yennefer, who you meet in The Witcher 3, and they were raising a child together, Ciri. And everyone's like, but dude, Yennefer's so bad. Like, she's toxic. Like, she was no good for you, man. Like, so we all kind of agreed that it was maybe for the best that you didn't remember her. And, like, God. You know, we thought she was dead anyway. Yeah. So, like, we kind of just thought to let this lie. And the game was on from this. Like, Geralt, this is the one thing. Like, Geralt's like, yeah, that tracks. And, like, he's totally, totally chill with it. Like, Dandelion knew about it. Triss knew about it.
Was it Triss's idea?
Triss, nobody else was there when Geralt is rescued. So it was Triss who initiates all this.
Okay.
And just, like, hushes everything else up. So, like, it starts with her, but, like, all his closest friends. Zoltan, the dwarf, I think, is also in it. They're all cool with it. And I think as players, we're also sort of led to be like, yeah, I guess, I mean, it's Triss. Like, she's been your buddy for, like, 2.5 games at this point. Like, yeah, it's fine. But what's always sort of troubled me the most about this is, like, to me, this always makes, like, The Witcher writ large as, like, kind of a larger story about, like, controlling people we love and, like, manipulating them. And the ways that can sort of, like, change or taint things. And I don't think the game addresses with it... I don't think it addresses it head-on or deals with it particularly successfully, but it does... Like, The Witcher 3 is literally about, like, Geralt wrestling with the realization that, like, he's kind of accidentally abandoned his family. Because nobody told him he had one. And totally, like, vanished from Yennefer's life. And has got to deal with all of that. And I always thought it was just it's a weird thing about The Witcher is that Geralt is somebody who was, by all accounts, like, yes, legitimately probably in a toxic relationship, even if not, like, an abusive one. But then all his friends decide they know best for him. And in a position where he's infirm and weakened, they go about, like, just radically changing, like, key fundamental, like, facts of his life without his consent. To sort of make him the sort of person the better version of himself they all know he could be.
It's pretty fucked up. I mean, no one among us has ever not had, I think, the temptation to make someone date someone else if you hate their partner, if you think they're bad for someone. But non-consensually, like, involving someone in a relationship is just a complete and utter... mindfuck. I didn't know this when I started playing Witcher 3, and I, you know, sort of was like, yeah, Triss, she seems great, and kind of had this whole relationship with her, and then sort of found that context out later, and I was upset. I was mad for Geralt. I was not happy about sort of the way it went down, which, you know, again, it's not the same thing, obviously, as something like the Bloody Baron, but it is as important to kind of contend with. And I like that the game is messy in certain ways. Although there is, like, a weird gendered aspect to this where it's like, oh, well, we kind of let that slide a little bit, yet, you know, be, you know, I don't like, and I've never liked, that people will assume that women will always treat people well. Like, I'll be honest, like, I was in an abusive relationship with a woman. Like, women are absolutely capable of abuse, as well as men are. Which I know doesn't always look like the sort of traditional narrative, as if a traditional narrative about it ever makes sense to have, because everyone has a different experience, right? But I remember being very upset, sort of finding this out about Triss, because of that. Like, assuming, like, oh, what's a woman going to do? You know? Like, oh, it's fine, whatever. She's just helping him out, man. And it's like, no, that's not what's going on here. That's... seriously messed up.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, I do want to talk a lot about redemption, and there's a character, or a couple of characters. We can move to Star Wars a tiny bit, because I think this is actually super relevant here. Pivot to Star Wars. Ready? Ready?
You only get 25 minutes, Natalie.
Space right. time.
We've got space time now, exactly. From The Witcher to the wilds of space. There is a almost kind of ridiculous thread here, and I'm gonna frame this as a key question here. If there is a point of no return, is there a point of no return for a character in fiction, if not sort of in life, right, where they've done something so bad and so fucked up that, no, it doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter if they rescue puppies every day for the rest of their life. There's no sort of getting back on the cosmic scale of good. And the sort of key example of this, of course, is Darth Vader, who has killed billions, trillions, I don't know how many, countless lives.
Lots.
But gets to be, you know, the redemption figure at the end, because he restored the balance of power in the Force. And they're obviously doing some things like this with Kylo Ren, which I know, Natalie, this is something you definitely wanted to talk about. But I do want to kind of have that framing of redemption. Is it useful to talk about redemption first and foremost? And second of all, is there sort of a calculus? Is there a point of no return?
I definitely think there is a point of no return for redemption. Sure. I mean, I think it's naive and, like you were saying earlier, Rob, dangerous to entertain the idea of redemption sometimes in some of these narratives. I think it's harmful and perpetuates sort of social norms or can perpetuate sort of social ideas that just normalizing these things in a way that is not good in my book. I hate what's happening with Kylo Ren. I'm
sure.
So mad at it all the time when I think about it, because I hate sort of this gotcha moment in these sort of narratives where they're like, he's the bad guy, he's the bad guy, he's the bad guy. Wait, gotcha. Actually, he's doing a good thing now. And I hate the way that they're like placing this sort of back and forth on Rey, who I don't like it. I don't like what's happening. I don't know really how to explain it. Perhaps someone else can go into it a little bit more, but I just don't think that showing bad guys doing good things is particularly interesting. It's like so fake deep to me. It's like so just, it's so superficial, and it's such like a cheesy thing to do. It just doesn't make the narrative more. I think it's like a very cheap way of creating depth to it. To add depth to a character that, like, doesn't actually go all the way through for me.
Sure. Rob, it looks like you've got some stuff.
Well, I don't know, but, like, he is fake deep, though. That's the thing. Like, what I like this because... Because,
yeah, see, it seems like it fits within the character. Like, he actually is, like, a complete facade. He's a paper-thin personality, not because he's underwritten, because he's, like, he is, like, a facade, like, through and through. And so the idea that he would be flip-floppy, a centrist on being evil,
if you will. That's very true. That's very true.
It actually, I actually am more sort of with Rob on this one, where I actually think, like, the fact that you're angry at, like, the anger you have towards him, I feel is actually reflective of the character being written in a specific way to elicit a certain reaction that plays into archetypes of Star Wars and riffs on Darth Vader specifically.
Right.
Here's my other question is, like, is it good actually? No. But there's an element of, like, like, in to a degree in this, Rey is being victimized with this fucking, like, emotional whiplash bullshit, and, like, the way that she is as a character keeps like opening the door for him to try and redeem himself, and then he plays his fucking mind games, like, well, I know the real secret of your parentage, and like, and then it culminates with him being like, you're nobody, you're nothing, but I can make you somebody. But what I like about that is this is exactly the sort of fuckboy behavior you should expect from a Kylo Ren. Like,
yep.
the whole thing is, like, he believes that he can redeem himself. Like, yes, I've done all these bad things, but I'll have my moment where I turn to good. And for him, that means replacing Snoke with himself. For him, that's like, yeah, I killed the big bad guy. Now I'm going to be the fascist, and you're going to be my emotional victim and sidekick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's like Rey's coming out of, you know, maybe being like the most isolated person ever. She just has no emotional connection to anything. The only emotional connection she has is to sort of the idea of her parents that are so far in her past that they're just, I don't know, complete figments of her imagination at this point. And so, and then she gets introduced to like the whole, you know, world of the resistance, and there's a lot of deep connections there, but her connection with Kylo is like the connection of the Force, which is like they're able to communicate with each other on this other level. And I just hate the fact that like her one intimate or just the most intimate connection that she has is with this like toxic relationship. I mean, I like that she has this like jovial, like happy, you know, sort of buddies become heroes story with Finn. But I hate for her the fact that like as she's figuring all of her shit out, as she's figuring, you know, out who she is, that the most insight she's getting is from Kylo, or at least it's the one that is the most influential in her head at this point.
He's a terrible toxic boyfriend. Sorry, go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, I was just gonna say, like, I think a lot of like how it like where this falls is like where the character like ends up at the end of like the next film.
Totally.
Like, it's I don't feel great that it's in. I'm a huge J.J. Abrams backer, and I think he did a lot of really difficult things wildly successfully with The Force Awakens. But like, I don't feel great about like his ability to land the narrative on this, because The Last Jedi was such a like specific repudiation of a lot of the things that he set up in The Force Awakens. And the way those movies riff on each other is like one of my favorite things about the dichotomy of those two films. But I think there's a way where you're totally vindicated in like how you feel about those characters. I think a lot of it rests on like how where do they if it's that Kylo Ren brings balance to the Force and ultimately becomes like a good dude. Like that's like a really unsatisfying arc, even if there's a parallel with Darth Vader. But like he hasn't earned that. And so like my hope is that character ends up truly being a fuckboy by the third one, and like there's a rejection,
full fuckboy status.
Yeah, it's an outright rejection by Rey in some way. He is like these movies are building to him being the big bad, but if these movies play out the way that they should, or the way I'm reacting to the character in the way that I think it wants me to, is that it's setting him up as a big bad, but he's actually just a small boy, and that the third film should be like the reveal of that movie, like the way these it's crescendoing is actually like to revel and reveal his patheticness, and Rey to essentially like squash him under her Jedi heel, and I think that would be like a very satisfying arc for those two characters.
Totally.
I think the other thing is that with Vader, the entire reason, like, so like, literally in Return of the Jedi, Luke's whole argument with Vader is like, there's still good in you. I sense it. And really the response is, yeah, probably. There's good in most people. How much good? You know what I mean? Like, how much does it fucking matter?
Right. And if it's just a tiny percentage, does that mean you're like you are allowed to be like what's the percentage we got to get over? Redemption is fast. How many stat points do I got to pump into?
And the really childish morality of the original trilogy, where everything is like literally described as like dark or light. You're either full dark or full light. The fact that there's this like little glimmer in Vader means that in the end, you know, oh, you belong actually back on the side of the angels. And what I like what they're doing here is that, like, yeah, there might be, like, some good in Kylo. There might be some humanity and, like, sympathy with him. End of the day, he's going to choose to be a piece of shit. Because he is a piece of shit. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, he loves his mom. Doesn't want to kill his mom. Okay, watching his wingman kill his mom. Like, that's who he is, yeah. Right? Like, yep. And in the Star Wars conception of morality, not being able to personally murder your mom, good. In the Rian Johnson version of that, like, not being able to, like, personally kill your mom, yeah, of course you can't kill your mom, you fucking idiot. Of course not. You still sack of dog shit.
Yeah, good abs, though.
He does. That's the thing. Adam Driver just makes that character so much more interesting, thanks to his performance, than I think I would have been interested in that character in the slightest otherwise, for sure. Which is, you know, that's a craft point. I want to ask, and this is something we've been dancing around a little bit, especially at the beginning of the discussion, but I do want to kind of like ask this as a question to the table here, of sort of what degree does the framing of an abusive character as sympathetic, does that make excuses in some way for their behavior? And is it naive or toxic to do it at all, to make an abusive character, or a character that is, you know, shown to be abusive in the fiction? Is it naive to do that, or is it sort of struggling with something bigger? And this is a big question. It's a big question for fiction. It's a big question for games. But I think it's an important one to sort of contend with here. First crack. There we go, Natalie.
I'll go for first crack. I think for me, it really is dependent on... I don't think there's like a yes or no to this. I think it's so dependent on like the context. And as we were saying before, you know, when there are layers, external layers placed on those kind of narratives of abuse that are, you know, whether it is like alcoholism or drug addiction, I see less danger in adding sort of a sense of sympathy, because I do think there is a chance for redemption in those. When people are like doing shitty things because they want something, like, you know, because it's always like they want something, and I think that I'm less sympathetic to that, or I see more danger in just presenting abuse as is and then asking for sympathy. Like, with, I said I wasn't gonna bring him up, but I guess I'll bring him up really quick. Like Humbert of Lolita, like, classic example, just presenting abuse in a really romanticized way. Like, that does not deserve any sort of sympathy or mask of sympathy or anything of that nature. So for me, it's really, as someone who reads these stories coming from a background of having been in an abusive relationship in the past with, you know, someone that struggled with drug addiction, I take it I guess I wouldn't say I take it personally, but I do think it's very dangerous to ever normalize or justify or do those kinds of things in these situations, because that's what that person was doing to me. You know what I mean? That's exactly the things that person did for our relationship, was to normalize or justify or rationalize those behaviors. And that was the hardest thing to break the cycle of. So that's my hot take on that question.
Good one. Yeah. Rob, you look like you're on the cusp.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like I'm kind of there as well. Like, I'm really wary of, again, through, we do this in life, but also with story logic, this impulse toward pathologizing behavior. and saying, ah, here is what it was founded on. If we look here, the cycle of abuse explains why this person who is behaving like an absolute piece of shit, actually, they're just perpetuating a cycle that didn't start with them. So to an extent, maybe we should understand and forgive them. I'm like, I can understand it. I may not have an interest in forgiving it. And I think that's where I come down. But in stories...
Yeah, it takes away culpability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, that's where I get really wary of these things, where anytime a story introduces this idea that, like, there's some, you know, Rosetta Stone of character that we can find that translates the behavior today, you know, into its origins. And in so doing, somehow, like, that's the key to a lock. No, it isn't. Like, understanding is not a doorway to change. Like, understanding is a doorway to understanding. That's all it will give you is perspective and a little bit of insight.
Yeah.
But I think stories prime us for this notion that, like, well, if we understand it, we can change it. We can diagnose it and we can attack it. I've known a lot of people, you know, who've had bad behaviors who were very good at explaining or contextualizing where they were coming from. Didn't change things.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else to add except that for a half second when I was zoning out that you said abuse origins and I was like, is that like a game that I haven't heard of?
It's going to be.
Oh, yeah, it's God of War 1-3.
It will be now. There it is. Exactly.
All right, well, end the podcast, please. You're done.
Well, that's the new game. Yeah, exactly. So I only wanted to end this. Obviously, there's no Pat answers for this. Oh, Patrick, sorry. There's a Pat answers thing. I did not mean to make a pun. I want to just be clear.
I wanted the podcast to end before, but now I really want it to end.
Now you want it to super end. The last note I want to say, an organization, if some of these issues, particularly for sexual violence, but RAIN is a really good organization for folks who might want some resources around that. It's RAINN. I believe it's Rape, Abuse, Incest Network. National Network. That's what it is. I was like, is it Network National? No, it's National Network. They are at RAINN.org, and they have some really good resources in case some of the stuff today on this podcast brought up some bad feelings or stuff you want to talk about. So I'm just going to go through the typical ending. You can send questions. We didn't do questions today, but if you do have those questions, you can send them to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shout-outs, as always, to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. We're on twitch.tv/Waypoint. And you can read everything we write, including Patrick's excellent piece, at waypoint.vice.com. Patrick, where can we find you online?
At Patrick Lubbock.
Awesome. Natalie, how about you?
At Natalie Watson on Twitter.com.
Awesome. Rob, how about you?
At Rob Zachney.
Awesome. You can find me at Danielle R.I. if you so choose to follow me. And I remind you today and this weekend, and as always, to please be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.